Welcome to Innovators Inside, the podcast for people working in corporate innovation, brought to you by Alchemist X, the corporate services division of Alchemist Accelerator. Here, you'll follow host Rachel Chalmers, head of Alchemist X, as she talks to the industry's highest achievers and most compelling thought leaders. These are fly-on-the-wall conversations with leading practitioners in the field. They'll share their lessons learned so that you don't have to go through the painful experiences that they did. So sit back, relax, and get ready to level up.
Today, it's my great pleasure and privilege to welcome Christy Zuber to the show. Christy is the founder and managing director of Aspen Labs and holds a doctorate in design and innovation from Coventry University. She's also on the faculty of Northwestern and has served as fellowship faculty for Arizona State. This all is the culmination of a distinguished career in corporate innovation that included founding and directing the innovation consultancy for Kaiser Permanente. Christy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure, Rachel. Thank you for inviting me.
Always great to talk to you. Can you walk us through the work that you did at Kaiser?
No, I would love to. I would love to walk you through my time at Kaiser. It was there for about 16 years, so it was a pretty interesting and elaborate path. It's kind of funny. I actually came in through Kaiser in their finance area, which is a bit unusual. I don't necessarily have a finance background, but they were looking for someone that had some, at the time it was Big Five consulting background and healthcare experience, and they were trying to set up some sort of internal things there at Kaiser. So I said, you know, I'd be happy to come in because it's an amazing organization. But my request was within about 2 years that I would be able to get closer into not providing direct patient care, but affecting patient care. That's really where my passion is. And so at about that 2 year mark, probably about a year and a half into it, I start saying, okay, we're getting close. You know, I'm ready to start kind of getting into that space. And it was right about the time when IDEO had been interviewed for the Nightline special that Ted Koppel did.
Yes. Yes. It's an amazing video.
I always wonder how many people were affected by that in some way, shape or form, either, you know, were, became interested or sold business off of it or something.
A lot, I think. We'll link to that in the show notes. But yeah, it's still worth watching. What, 16, 18 years later?
Yeah. Yeah. And you'll notice it when you watch it, how much the technology examples and things have changed. So it definitely dates itself in that. But the lessons behind it are really, they're pretty classic and tried and true. So that was one of those times. And they were talking about, you know, we can innovate all sorts of things. And they gave the example from, you know, we can innovate from a, you know, an electronic well from the Free Willy movie, you know, into, you know, a pair of tennis shoes or, you know, a defibrillator. You know, these things don't presumably have anything to do with each other, but it's the way in which we do it. And so at the time I was doing work for our COO and she had said, this sounds like some of the things that you had talked about in your past. I was a hospital administrator at a children's hospital before, and I'd handed out like disposable cameras and asked the kids, because at the time that was what there was available. You know, this was the 90s. I had the kids do little pictures and take journal entries of their experience while they were in the hospital, particularly kids that had cancer and were there for long periods of time. And I just said, you know, we use that to try to change around our hospital. So this Nightline thing came out with IDEO and shopping cart. And she said, this sounds like the things you used to talk about in your past. And I watched it and I thought, oh my gosh, I've found my tribe. Like, that is what I want to do. What I was doing didn't really have some sort of codified terms for it. At the time, it was just patient and family centered care. And when I found out, oh, there's a methodology, you know, this human centered design, there's a methodology, you can build up your practice. And so I was hooked and I was so excited. And that's actually, she said, okay, we'll see if you can talk to them and if you can try to bring this into Kaiser and if we can internalize it ourselves. And at the time, IDEO had never done anything like that. They were helping to create some, usually a product of some sort.
Yep.
And, you know, and here we are, healthcare, you know, organization. So they said, well, I don't know, it's not really what we do. And we talked about it back and forth and we decided to try it. And we actually ended up partnering together for about 2 years. And in that 2 year time period, my team and I that I had put together began to learn and build up ourselves as practitioners. And they began to understand how to teach others how to do this. And so it became a whole practice branch for them and it became our internal practice. And we just grew it over time. Our first entity was the innovation consultancy. And then we built up and opened up several different innovation centers in Oakland, California and Washington, DC and different entities all across the organization. We have about 210,000 employees. So it's a pretty sizable organization. And that was how we ended up founding the human-centered design for innovation practice across the company.
It's so cool. I feel like that moment, the reason that that Nightline show was so impactful was that it was a corrective to what had become a very almost authoritarian, a very structured technical way of approaching problems, and reintroducing the human at the center was welcomed by so many people who wanted to make systems and infrastructure a lot more humane. I think it was landing on really fertile soil, particularly within an organization like Kaiser, which is so mission-driven.
Yeah, you know, Rachel, it's funny you bring that up, because what was interesting is Kaiser was founded during World War II, and it started out with really, really scrappy beginnings. It was all men that worked in the shipyards at the time, and it was men that were too old or too sick to be drafted into the war. And so Henry Kaiser paired up with a physician called Sidney Garfield, and their whole positioning was, well, if we can keep these people healthy, then they can actually work on these big ships, these warships, to help in the war. And that was really how it started. So the preventative approach to, you know, let's make sure they don't get tetanus, let's treat them before they get the flu, let, you know, all these different things so that they were healthy and productive was really the start of it. And so it was a very nimble, agile, you know, innovative organization. And just like many organizations, you grow and you grow and you grow and you put in structures and, you know, things that are all very necessary. But sometimes you sort of get to a point where you know, as an organization, you look at yourself in the mirror and say, where happened to our nimbleness? You know, we don't hold that place anymore. We've built up so much of our energy into the structures and maintaining the structures. We've lost that sense of nimbleness. So that's really what was bringing back into, can we find an actual approach and methodology to be able to do this and find some of that nimbleness and that innovative spirit again?
These themes come up again and again in these conversations that we have around corporate innovation. This idea that a corporation is a bunch of people coming together to manage their shared risk in the first place, then that risk aversion becomes baked into the structure and it becomes very difficult to take the kinds of risks you need in order to manage the risk of disruption. It's always walking that dynamic tension between protecting people and gambling on future outcomes.
Which is makes sense. I mean, if you think about most organizations, a way that somebody sort of makes their way up in the corporate ladder is less about taking a risk as it is making sure that you don't end up doing something wrong. I think people, their careers, the way that they work, gets more and more protective and safe, and you lose the muscle to be able to take it. You lose the infrastructures that support it. And so, you know, what is it that the quota system is perfectly designed to do, you know, what it, or what is, there's some quota on that. They're perfectly set up to do whatever the output is, something like that. But
yes.
Basically, yeah. if we think that we want to be able to be a more innovative company that actually takes risks, then you have to be set up to do that. You have to reward it. You have to set up the systems and the structures to do that. And we're not usually set up that way.
Yeah, I call those survival strategies that have outlived their usefulness. You know, you get really, yeah, really good at navigating a corporation as it is, but it changes anyway. But
yeah,
it's also true on the flip side. Those of us who come from early stage and startup backgrounds, we get into these big corporations, and to the people who grew up there, we must seem insanely risk-taking. And naturally, we tend to have quite short tenures in these organizations, which is fine.
That's
with
so
us.
True.
But
that is very true.
It yeah, looks suicidal from the other side.
It does. It does. Like, what are these people doing? They're coming in and they're just causing total chaos.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 It very much feels like that. You know, I think it's like anything. You know, if you're in a large organization and you want to behave differently, then you have to build up the muscle and the structures to do that. And it sounds so logical. You know, let's bring in people from the outside who have this, you know, kind of in their DNA. But you have to realize it's like I'm a healthcare clinician by background, and it's like antibodies. You get this sort of, you know, this thing injected, and all your body wants to do is reject it, you know, get it out, you know, isolate it, get it out. And so I think that's where, to me, the ability to lead differently, you know, where are the people that are making the place for this within the organization? Because it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen easily. But I think strong leaders can understand that there's going to be a rejection of this. And so both, how do you hold that at bay for a while? Some of the work that I did, the term that I use there are these kind of microclimates for innovation. How do you create these microclimates for innovation within an organization, because you're not going to change the organizational culture overnight. That takes typically somewhere between 5 and 10 years for a large organization.
Yes.
You know, those people are going to be long gone by that point. So how do you create these microclimates that can hold it, that can keep it, and then can begin to show other people in the organization to model how it's done differently? And that's, I think, the best way to start to change change that is microclimate by microclimate by microclimate. And then eventually you've role modeled it, you've shown it in these, you know, in these spaces, and the organization can begin to see how it might be able to do something differently.
Right. Or to go back to your antibody metaphor, the intrapreneurs become the vaccine. They persuade mm-hmm. the antibodies that the incoming disruption is not a threat and that the system can handle a certain amount of change.
I think so too. You know, and I think just even the way you said it, a certain amount of change, I think that's also the important part for people coming into an organization to understand is that organization is not going to flip itself inside out, most likely. You know, there's parts that will need to be kept stable. You know, maybe it's 80% of the company, maybe it's 20% of the company, but it's highly unlikely that the entire thing will shift. And so where is it where the organization maintains itself and maintains some kind of course to help to feed these new opportunities, these new growth places to happen. And so I think also being smart about, well, where is that? If you're coming in from the outside, what part of the organization are you a part of? Because I think sometimes we lump it in as one big thing. But, you know, honestly, in most big organizations, there's all kinds of different dynamics that are happening in different places. And so whether you're coming in to work in that organization or you're an entrepreneur on the outside trying to work with them, find those pockets because they always exist somewhere.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say that with Aspen Labs, you're taking the work that you did at Kaiser to a much wider audience?
Yes. And I'm actually working with many of the same people that used to be a part of my team when I was with Kaiser. So, you know, when you find great people that you love to work with, you tend to sort of stick together if at all possible. So many of us I've brought them along with me on this journey. When we did the work at Kaiser, we started doing this work back in 2002, 2003, and it wasn't really happening in other places outside of creating different products. And so using human-centered design as an approach to innovation to create new service offerings, different kinds of ecosystems and so forth was really, we were on very far out on the fringe away from mainstream, and particularly when you layered it into this kind of healthcare industry space. And so because of that, we had this opportunity to really meet amazing people in industries that we probably wouldn't have met otherwise, because, you know, like any other industry, healthcare tends to stick with healthcare, you know, airlines tend to stick with airlines, products, and, you know, they kind of group, right? You get your sort of flock and you group with those people most likely. But because we were in this new uncharted territory at the time, really the only people that we could be challenged by and learn from were people that were in completely different industries and organizations than us. And so we had the opportunity, you know, whether it was through speaking at conferences or being featured in publications where people would reach out to one another like, oh, I remember the day that Intuit had been featured in the Harvard Business Review for their Innovation Catalyst program. And then we were featured in the very next one around our innovations on the front lines. And we were both frantically trying to connect with one another because we had seen each other featured and said, oh my gosh, you know, we're what, 25 minutes from each other? Why are we not connecting and sharing? And we did. And it was a fantastic relationship. And I still keep in touch with some of them. So, you know, those kinds of things that really opened up, I think, what I realized was possible. And so I continued that in founding Aspen Labs is I love healthcare and I will always love healthcare. So, you know, that is in, you know, as a part of me and a part of my purpose. I also love and value and appreciate all these other industries from a different lens, but also then what I can bring back. So it's really rich, fertile soil. So we've had a really great time introducing people in different spaces that may not have necessarily met each other, but have a common way that they want to work and a common North Star with, you know, focusing in on people, whether it's, you know, the customer that you're creating something for, or it might be users inside of your own company and your people. And it's been a really lovely, exciting time, I would say, for the last several years in doing that and creating this whole new network of people together.
It's the perfect name for that. The Aspen, this huge forest that's all connected at the root.
It's one of, space-wise, it's the largest living organism on the planet, the aspen groves. And so it's that was really intentional. You know, we thought about it for a long time. And that was what we loved is, you know, the idea of people connected together and growing and being stronger because they're supporting each other. And so that idea of this aspen grove and then the lab is because we're always learning and always experimenting. And that's really what a lab is all about, is a place for learning and experimentation. So we paired those things together.
So your secret agenda is to take over the planet. Okay, noted.
Yeah, planetary overlord. Largest living organism. That's right. Is that weird? I don't know. Should I have said that out loud?
So we've talked a lot about the successes and the benefits of innovation, but you know, it's never that easy. When the rubber hits the road, the devil is always in the details. What are your enterprise clients struggling with the most these days?
You know, it's interesting. Several different things. I would say one of the things is enterprise clients, I think, struggling with who are we now? Is it the same? Is it different? Because for many people, fundamentally what they do is shifting. And for some, it's for the good. Some, you know, if you look at spaces like, you know, whether it's telemedicine, for example, you know, new things have just like blown open, you know, regulations have changed, reimbursements have changed, you know, all sorts of things. And so the field is opening up. But for many others, fundamentally what they do is really being challenged. And so I would say one of the things that they're really struggling with is who are we really? What is it that we're really here to do? What is it that we're really trying to solve and to offer for? And if it is different than where we are right now, how in the world do we actually change? Do we have that in us? And so I think that has caused a lot of people to not feel as confident about their path as they did before, and layering into that the sense that they're working apart. For some people, that feels great. For others, they feel very disconnected from one another. And when you're trying to have difficult conversations, set new strategies, communicate ideas that are probably better set to be fluid and always changing, but now they're boxed into a 30-minute call with your team on Zoom or something. You know, that's a different way of interacting and working. And so I'm seeing a lot of people losing that kind of hallway, water cooler, you know, whatever dynamic that keeps the ball moving forward, that piece has broken out. And so I think both it's that mindset and that vision of who are they, and that underpinning of how that vision gets created and brought into a strategy and executed because the fluidity of the conversation has changed.
Because those two things are deeply interconnected, your sense of identity and how you build that in relationship, in interaction with other people's sense of identity. It's interesting because that's clearly happening both at the corporate level as corporations search for their new unique selling proposition, but also at the personal level, you know, yes. The number of friends I have who got laid off and you know, now pursuing their tailored garment business or training to be a death doula. It's something that we're all coming face to face with our mortality in such a graphic way. Has forced a reassessment.
It is. And just in seeing the places that, you know, have to kind of lean into that, maybe not knowing how to do it very well. And are you okay with it being a little clunky to start with? And, you know, and trying to do it differently because it can't be done the same way that it was done before. And it's funny, you know, enterprise client wise, I would say we had a pretty sizable chunk of them that in the beginning kept saying, you know, there's a lot that we need to be doing right now, but this is that we want to be able to get together. And so we're just going to wait. And so things were punted, and you're seeing those come back up and go, we can't wait anymore. You know, there's not going to be anything that's substantially different between now and next March. We have to figure out how to do this differently now. So I think you're seeing that come back in, which I would think, you know, is an opportunity for those enterprise clients. And I would also say an opportunity for, you know, the startups in how they work with them and, you know, how they can support them in that.
When you look back on your work in corporate innovation, what are you proudest of?
You know, a couple things. One, I would say right off are the teams that I brought together and developed. Because I think if you don't know how to set the conditions and develop really empowered, excited people and teams that are better together in a real multiplying effect than they ever would have been apart, it fizzles. There's a lot of people with a lot of good ideas. But I think if you can create really good teams, and this might sound really corny, but you know, I don't care. What my superpower is, I would say it's people and teams. I love forming good teams and developing people that can eventually just surpass what I could know and do. I think that's the best thing to be able to do. So I would say that's one of the things that I'm the most proud of there. And I would say through that, because that became the vehicle for, you know, for everything else, through those teams. And some of these, you know, obviously there are a lot of teams that I was directly responsible for, but I would also say, you know, when you work in big organizations, you form teams all over the place that might not directly report to you, but you're doing work through them as well. And so so through this, you know, sort of amplified network across the organization, we created some really great things that addressed really complicated topics, and they were actually implemented, put in place, and are still there to this day. And at this point, you know, millions of people have been affected by it. Some of them, you know, life-changing things that have, you know, have literally saved lives. And that's really exciting to me. And also a number of those things were released out into the organization. And so sometimes I'll see postings for things of, you know, looking for a project manager to implement ABC, you know, solution. And it's something actually that we had created at Kaiser Permanente that was released to the world. And now other organizations are looking for hiring people to implement it within their organization. And, you know, just seeing that go out there is a really, that's just beyond delightful. That's really exciting. So I would say those are some of the things that I'm the most proud of. And it's continued. You know, I think if you create something and it goes away, once you leave, then there's something kind of wrong. Those things are still going on. And so, you know, I still keep in touch with everyone. We, you know, we still collaborate on things, and it's a fantastic group of people. So that momentum is just, is growing and continuing to move on. So it's great.
Just to make things really concrete for our listeners, yeah, do you have some examples of how you've saved lives?
Yeah. So several different kinds of things. I would say, so one of them is, and this sounds very simple. I love simple examples that don't have to get too technical. So this is very simple. So this is a solution. It's just, and it's called Nurse Knowledge Exchange. And all it is fundamentally is about how nurses communicate. So we were given at one point in time, nursing communication scores is one of the things that hospitals are measured by. And those measurements also translate into reimbursement and various different kinds of things. So it's very important. And so we were asked, you know, can you go in and look at nurse communications? That seems very sort of ambiguous, like what in the world is going to come from, you know, in general communications. Long story short, we did lots of field observations and kind of narrowed things down. And one of the most important times was shift change. And what happens at shift change is you have basically twice the amount of nursing staff there, and they have 30 minutes that overlaps together. And during that 30 minutes, you have to communicate all, what all has happened on your shift over to the next shift. That was being done in a completely disconnected way at the time. The nurses weren't actually even talking directly. They were recording information for each other and kind of writing notes and doing things very separately. So we overhauled that whole process, built it in with the new electronic medical record. They come into the bedside together and talk with the family and their loved ones together. And so what's happened now are those gaps in communication where medication errors happen, where patients get confused, they get up and look for help, they fall, which leads to all sorts of other areas. Safety things aren't checked. So through that nurse communication and that, that the way that it's changed now, they've caught errors with, you know, the oxygen wasn't hooked up and set in the right place. They've caught medication issues. They've caught people before they fell so that they didn't hurt themselves. They've caught changes with their conditions and alert levels and, you know, are they oriented and, you know, is there, are they progressing in the way that they should be and maybe that they're not, because they're actually talking together and not just the nurses talking together, but talking with the patient and their family members. So what happens now is the family members know this very specific way of communicating, and there's tool, like I said, there's tools, technology, all sorts of things that are supporting it, but the family members now know. So the family members are coming into the room and they're planning their schedules so that they're there at the bedside with the patient during this time. And so it's this very patient, family-centered approach, as opposed to what really was more of a technical handoff of information between clinical staff.
That's so brilliant. It leans into the fact that nobody wants to do a bad job. Nobody wants to make mistakes. But when you have the very high bandwidth of face-to-face interaction, plus the real stakes of the patient and their family members being there, you know, these are the humans who are at risk. Everything comes together.
It does. And those are the kind of examples, you know, you find out what the real need is. Like I said, we did technology changes in the electronic medical record to support how that communication flow would happen. We created a new tool called a care board that was put up in the rooms. It's in thousands and thousands of rooms. There's a whole company that's all they make now are care boards. You know, so these create all sorts of opportunities to support this on a bigger level. And I think unless you're on the inside of these organizations, you don't realize how one shift in something like that can create all these amazing opportunities in this whole ecosystem for something to shift around. It's now a part of orientation for all the new nurses that show up. You know, that's one of the examples that's being implemented. You know, I've seen it in the UK in Canada and in Switzerland. You know, this it's being implemented all over the place. And they, it has definitely had a direct tie into saving lives, reducing injuries, and quite frankly, I think providing care in the way that people want it to be provided, so that it's not a paternalistic exchange of things. It's a really, this is, you know, nothing about you without you sort of approach.
In turn comes from the disability advocacy movement. Mm-hmm. And if any of our listeners haven't seen the completely amazing documentary, I think it's on Netflix, called Crip Camp, about the origins of the ADA and the amazing activists who pulled together to make that happen. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary document.
Yes, nice. Nice plug. That's a good one.
Okay, now we're going to give you one magical do-over. You can look back over your entire career and you get a mulligan. There's one thing that you can change. What are you going to change?
You know, one thing that I think I would change, I think when I was doing the work that I was doing, and not just me, obviously, with my teams, I was so focused on the work itself that I missed the vantage point that the way that we did things and even some of the solutions that we came up with of how we could have packaged and shared far more than what we did because we were just in the middle of it. You know, it's like a fish in water. And now in being out of it, I realize how absolutely unique and special that was and how hard it is to replicate that in other organizations. Not that it's not possible, but it's hard. And I think we learned so many lessons and we tried and failed at so many things. And if I could do over, I would magically go back. I don't know how exactly I would do it, but I would magically go back and maybe have, you know, I don't know if it's work with like a PhD student or a little team of interns or something that would almost, you know, start speaking of documentaries, you know, almost like just capture this stuff and be able to better tell the story and share the learnings. You know, I mean, we've done that, but boy, it's, you know, it just really scratches the surface on what that could have been and how much that could have benefited other people. So I think if I could have a do-over, that's probably what I would do, is have that, you know, have that lens into it that I have now, but I didn't really have at the time.
That's a really good one, because the work that you and your teams did at Kaiser is so singular. And from my perspective, it does come from this sense of mission, from the really high stakes of literally your patients' lives depend on you doing a good job. It's much harder with corporations working in more sort of abstract areas of value to persuade them even of the importance of going out and doing customer discovery. It's really hard sometimes to get it people is. Out of the building.
It is. It's really hard. And, you know, and layer on to where we are right now, it's even harder. I mean, you know, through some of the great programs that you guys have done at Alchemist, we worked with a group of people that were inside of an organization and had some ideas for what would happen on the factory floor. But they had actually never been on the factory floor, and their organization had all kinds of factories. And so we kept saying, go out there, just connect up. Oh, we can't do that. We can't do that. You absolutely can do that. Go out there. And man, it taken them months to try to articulate and get clear about what it is that they were doing. And they went out there, and within a week, their focus came into place. They could articulate what they were doing. They tossed out things that they had been just mulling around for so long. They're like, oh, we got out there and that made no sense whatsoever once we were actually out there. And so what that can do is just so amazingly powerful. And I think it's tricky right now. You have to be even more creative about how those opportunities come up. And they still can, but you just have to be a little bit more creative about finding them. And I think it's even more important now. You know, it doesn't, just because it's harder for us to all physically be together, doesn't mean that the customer or user or stakeholder, whatever voice, is any less important than it was before. You just have to use a bit more creativity in how you access it.
I think there's a real opportunity now as well, because we're all stuck at home and we're all reassessing what value we deliver. I mean, I've been having a lot of success just getting people on the phone to have, you know, contemplative discussions about where the industry is going. And I think perversely, even though we're all so separated, there is an opportunity here to connect at a different level.
I agree. And, you know, in being able to do that and have those conversations with people and bring the humanity back into it, you know, that's what I think is so exciting, because even if you're not working with something like, you know, the examples I've been giving with patient care, you still, at the end of something, there's a person, you know, whether it's a person that's using the software or a person that's interacting with that piece of equipment or a person that is, you know, maintaining that infrastructure. There's a person somewhere that's doing something, that's making some decision, that's nervous about something not working. You know, there's always a person. And I think what I've found in working in this way that is, I think, the most rewarding is just reconnecting back with that. Because at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we're wired for connections and purpose. And you don't have to save the life of someone in a hospital to find purpose. There is purpose in all sorts of things that we do. And if you can make someone's job work more easily, if you can help someone sleep better at night because they know that that grid's not going to go down, or, you know, whatever it is, I think taking the opportunity to reach out and to have those conversations and to understand that context of the people that interact with those products and services, it will help you find that purpose and think much more creatively and holistically about what those amazing opportunities can be. And so I think, you know, to your point, taking advantage of that and having those, you know, maybe now is a great time to have conversations with people that might not give you the time other times, or it might be more difficult. You know, most people are home now. Take advantage of that and really get to more of that human root of what it is that they're trying to do, what things they're worried about, what's aspirational for them, and to see what you can do to help make that, you know, come to life.
It's so easy listening to you to see how you've been pulled into education and reflecting on all of your experiences. As you look back on your time at Kaiser, how do you distill all of that into discrete lessons that you can share with our listeners?
You know, that probably several different lessons. I would say one is, don't take yourself too seriously. So for whatever that's worth, you know, I think there are many times that I would feel like, my gosh. And what I realized was happening is I don't know everything and I can make mistakes and I will make mistakes and that's all right. So give yourself a little leeway, you know, don't take yourself so seriously. And I think if you have that mindset, then you can experiment and you can try and you can be much more of this open person that people want to work with, because boy, you can sniff it out when someone takes themselves seriously. They act like it, everything is like buttoned up and tied up and, you know, and you should be just as perfect as they are. It doesn't actually exist. So I think those people that elude that, like, I got it, we're learning here. That's one of the big lessons, I would say. I would also say other lessons are, I'm a big proponent of finding partners in an organization. So let's say if you're in a big enterprise, I think it's really easy to work so hard that you start feeling like it's kind of you against the world because you're trying to move a big ship. And I think the same thing can probably happen in startup companies, although I would guess it happens more in larger companies. And reaching out and finding those, who's your partner in crime? You know, who is your posse of people that is your go-to that, you know, when you're really excited about something, or when you really feel like, man, I just screwed it up today. Or I've got this idea and sounds ridiculous, but I need to talk it out with somebody. Who is that for you? And I think that also helps with your sustainability, with your kind of whole person health, that I never underestimate the power of people that have those partners in crime. And it doesn't have to be someone that's, maybe they're on your team, maybe they're not on your team, you know, in terms of like your department, but it doesn't matter. It's just that you have them and they've got your back, you've got their back, and you're better because of it. I think that that's a really, really important thing.
A pro tip for any intrapreneurs who have ever thought of doing their own startup, that work spouse, the person who laughs at your joke, the person you're back channeling with in Slack, that's the profile of your co-founder.
I totally agree. It is. It's a sustainability thing. And you can be a better person and you can have better ideas and better outcomes because you're not isolated and alone in your own little echo chamber.
Yes. Yeah.
It really means a lot. I would say, you know, and other things from a maturity standpoint is, give people credit. Don't hoard credit. You know, and I think the same thing is actually around power. Credit, power, yes. All those sorts of things. It's a sign of a mature leader when you can give other people credit for things, when you can build up and empower other people and you don't hold it and think it's this finite thing. Credit and power aren't finite. You know, the more you grow them, the more you give them away, the more they blossom and the more it feeds on itself. And so I think that's something that, you know, for some people it takes them, and some people never get to that point. But I would say if there's a lesson, it's, man, if you want to really affect change and make impact and grow things, give credit and give power to people and let them be their best selves. Let them be celebrated. And don't hold it.
God, that's so true. That's a really deep one. How do you think the pandemic might affect corporations long term?
I think you're going to start to see the organizations who are able and willing to grow and expand and try to be something different and let go of some things, you know, slough off some things, and those that just aren't. I think the pandemic is going to force that in some organizations, you know, and you're already starting to see it. And that's where, you know, honestly, I hope that, you know, even from an economic standpoint, that some places that probably should fail are allowed to fail, because I do also think there's a lot of people that are waiting in their wings to jump in. And so I would say you either need to be that organization that's willing to step in and willing to try to do something different and give it a shot, or I hope the market allows you to, you know, your time. If you're one of those organizations that's just been waiting, you know, put me in, coach, that's waiting, you know, keep on the lookout and be bold and, you know, and step on in. You know, so I think those are the kinds of places that, man, you've got some exciting things ahead. And I think that's in all sorts of different industries. I think every industry has, you know, has their own version of who that is and what that looks like and why different, you know, openings are showing up for people. But I think it's that attitude of, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to understand what people need. This is more about what it is we're doing for other people than it is about ourselves, and, you know, do something useful, make a difference, and, you know, be willing to try.
Christy, you always show up with this pure, bright enthusiasm and energy. How do you avoid burning out?
I surround myself with amazing people, you know, people that I pale in comparison to. So, you know, I think that's it. I know that I can't be solely responsible for, you know, I don't know if you know, there's a children's book called How Full Is Your Bucket? I think that's what it's called.
Yes.
And the whole thing is, you know, there's this, like, we all have these invisible, if you saw me right now, I've got like my hands above my head, this invisible bucket that's above our head. And when it's full, it means, you know, we feel, you know, happy and whole, and we have something to give to people. And as that bucket gets depleted, we don't have it to give, because we don't have it in our bucket, so we can't give it to others. But when it's full, you know, we can kind of dump some of that out and give it to other people, and often then it, you know, then they give it back to us. And so I would say, be really mindful of who you surround yourself with, because, you know, you're the keeper of your bucket, but other people can either take things out of your bucket, or they can help to replenish your bucket. And so who you're around, what you're doing, and being mindful of that dynamic, I think makes all the difference in the world. I used to have a friend, she would use a similar thing. She called it your creativity quotient. So it's a little bit like that. She would, you know, it's like the main five people that you surround yourself with is kind of you look at that on average, and that's going to be your creativity quotient. I would say that kind of whole health, that what you're able to bring and give, that also comes with who you surround yourself with. I think it's really important, because, you know, you're rarely going to be around people that, if they're just looking at what they do with you as a transaction, they're never going to call out and say, you know what, I think you need a little time, or, you know what, let me cover that for you. But if you're around those people that do care about you, you're going to take care of each other, and you're going to be better together than you would have been apart.
And this is why so many of the strong women I know have their secret group chat, and every job application and every piece of writing that they do gets sub-edited by like five of their secret friends. And
right. It's really important. It's really important. Yeah. There's a little group that I started connecting with several months back, and we were like, let's watch the Yale Wellness course together and talk about it, or just take on different things so that you can keep patching yourself and filling yourself up and be able to be your best self.
What is the best way for our listeners to connect with or follow your work?
I would say a couple different ways, and I'm really trying to be better about things. So I would say, you know, a couple different ways is definitely connect with me on LinkedIn. Aspen Labs, we're just starting to create more content on YouTube about different lessons and things like that. So we're literally, you know, a matter of just a few weeks into that. We've got maybe 5 or 6 videos out there. So our Aspen Labs YouTube account is a nice way just to kind of see the different things that we're thinking of and what we're putting out there. We also have a LinkedIn channel. On Twitter, I'm at CZuber. And so that's another way to kind of keep up with what I'm doing.
What does the future look like for you personally?
There's something that I'm actually working on right now and that I'm really excited about. And this, actually, the pandemic has brought a lot of this to life. So, you know, I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners have heard a lot of things about, you know, when you talk about the divide of the haves and the have-nots, the pandemic has made that divide even wider than it was before, whether it's, you know, what kind of education do you have access to? What kind of food do you have access to? What, you know, what are you able to do for work? You know, can you work from home? Can you not? And so, you know, hourly jobs, jobs that are more labor-based jobs, people in lower income, it's getting harder and harder, and their incidence rates are much higher. And so it's just it's a multiplying effect. So one of the things that I've been really excited about that we're working on is we're trying to create more of an infrastructure to be able to do co-design to bring in people that are more in these populations of people that are more at risk. When people are creating new services, new products, they don't really have access to those kinds of people. But we're talking with several different foundations who are really excited about developing this. And so one of the first steps is more of a kind of a virtual ethnography, if you will, platform that exists but hasn't been used for these purposes. How we identify these people, we're working with several different national organizations that have more access and doing different sorts from, you know, income levels and so forth. But so beginning to bring people together in a cohort so that it's beneficial to them, and it's done in a very respectful way, and it's beneficial for people who are creating new products and services and things like that for more of these at-risk people.
And that's a great callback to Nothing About Us Without Us.
Yes, exactly. Because you can't have a voice if no one knows how to find you and reach out to you. So we're trying to take that friction out of it and just say, here's a way of doing that. You know, now let's take it from here and build out some really great things that really help these people that are in the greatest need.
That sounds fantastic. Much needed. As you look at the future of our industry, what is the rosiest, most optimistic outcome that you can imagine?
You know, I would say some of kind of what we're talking about, I think, you know, when you look at the things that our country and our world, I think, has gone through, I think being a future that is more inclusive of all kinds of people, I think a place where people have built up more capacity to have difficult conversations with one another and to be able to get to the root of things so that we're actually solving meaningful problems, not just stuff because it's easy to do, but things because it's necessary and important. I think a place where people have, and I see this happen over and over again, have found their a rekindled purpose that they might have felt that they lost. Because, you know, sometimes I think when things are easy, you kind of get on an autopilot. And when things get a little hard and get a little bumpy, I think you buckle up and you pay a little bit more attention. And so I think some people are more alert and awake and alive right now. And so I think bringing that out in people is just, you know, the power of the human spirit is one of the most amazing forces in our universe, and unleashing that for things that are important and good and life-giving. I think that's just, that would be an absolutely amazing outcome.
Wow, I want to live there.
We'll go, Rachel. Let's take the trip.
All righty, let's go. Christy, what else should I have asked you? Is there anything that I've overlooked?
I don't know what you have asked such great questions. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm excited about the opportunity to share some of the things that I'm noodling around, you know, in my head of, you know, what new things can be created out there. One of the things that I really appreciate with how you ask questions is, you know, often I get the, you know, the stereotypical, like, I can't believe a clinician is doing something so different. And I appreciate how you are very curious about phases that people go through and how they evolve and how they change. And so it's not anything that you missed. I think it's more thanking you for kind of calling that out in people and it not being this, you know, where you are at one moment in time, but what are all these different phases of who you are that brings you to where you are today? Because I think there's a lot of people that get excited about doing something different, but that's not necessarily how they see themselves yet. And, you know, if you would have asked the Christy in my early 20s who was doing home health nursing of the kinds of things that I was doing now, I would have had a really hard time wrapping my head around how in the world do I get from doing this to doing that. That's not a natural path. And so what I appreciate is how you ask questions about different phases and times in people's lives, because I think it helps others to know there's all kinds of things that they can do and that they can be, and there's not one path to get there.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I've really been leaning into my curiosity as a way of managing everything that's going on. I've found a lot of joy in just learning other people's stories and spending time looking at things from their point of view, which has been a real real pleasure.
Thank you.
Christy, I'm sure my listeners have an appreciation now for how much I enjoy working with you and what a delight it is. Thanks so much for coming on the show and for sharing all of these incredible insights from a really remarkable career.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. And I thank you for being on here. And I'm, you know, I hope that your listeners get something interesting and intriguing, and definitely feel free to reach out to me. And here's to whatever lies ahead for all of us.
Sounds good to me.
Thanks, Rachel.
This has been Alchemist X Innovators Inside. You can find the transcript of this conversation, plus links to whatever books, articles, TV shows, and apps we talked about on our blog. And stay connected by following us on Instagram and Twitter. If you found the podcast valuable, feel free to share or tell your colleagues. We love hearing from you. Send us your comments, feedback, suggestions for future guests, or just say hi by emailing us at axii@alchemistaccelerator.com.